You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Welcome to our panel on the first sale doctrine. I'm going to mostly dispense with introductions since I think people have that information in their materials, but just to go down the line, we've got Keith Kupferschmidt of the Software and Information Industry Association, Todd Cohen with eBay, Kristen Janetsky with the Entertainment Software Association, and John Austin-Macker with Redigi. And my name's David Sohn. I'm with the Center for Democracy and Technology here in Washington. The first sale doctrine goes back really about 100 years. It's been a key feature of copyright law since then, and it basically means that once you buy a copy of a copyrighted work, you can resell it, you can give it away, you can lend it, you can really do most of what you want with it. And that's a principle that has been crucial to the existence and operation of everything from libraries to used book and record stores to video rentals from Blockbuster to Netflix today. Back in 2001, the Copyright Office addressed the question of whether the digital revolution required changes to the first sale doctrine. And at that time, it concluded that no changes were necessary, but it also took kind of a wait-and-see approach. It said there could be issues that could arise down the road that might require a second look at that. And that was, it's 2001, so that's 12 years ago now. And today there are some cases pending that raise some pretty weighty issues for the first sale doctrine. The Supreme Court is considering Kurtzsang v. Wiley, which is a case that's reviewing a Second Circuit decision that said that the first sale doctrine does not apply to copies of copyrighted works that are manufactured abroad, in that case, textbooks. In the meanwhile, there's also just a sort of a bigger, long-standing question about how or if first sale should apply in a world where increasingly copyrighted goods are distributed in digital form, so not a tangible copy, but rather just a file on a hard drive or other computer server somewhere. John's company, Redigi, is at the center of that debate as it's currently participating in a case on that subject as it tries to facilitate a resale market for digital works. So what I think we'll do is maybe talk about the Kurtzsang issues first and then go to the broader question of what does first sale mean in a world where so many goods are digital. On Kurtzsang, I'll just start with the quick disclosure that my organization, CDT, did file a brief in that case in conjunction with eBay, so just so everybody knows about that. But I'm going to turn to Todd to maybe describe briefly the case and what's at stake there from your perspective.
So the simple description of the case is Mr. Kurtzsang, an eBay seller, a doctoral student at USC, came to America and had his friends and family and himself ship textbooks purchased in authentic textbooks purchased in Thailand, brought to the United States, and then resold on the eBay platform. And he also sold it independent of eBay. He sold it on other platforms also. John S. Wiley and Sons filed a copyright infringement suit against him, one at the lower court, claiming that Section 602 provided them with the importation right, and that he violated the importation right by importing these goods into the United States without their authorization, and that the first sale doctrine did not apply because under Section 109, the first sale doctrine includes the provision under this title, and that the words under this title meant that it had to be manufactured in the United States. Because the goods were not manufactured in the United States, the first sale doctrine did not apply, and therefore he was in key violation. He had copyright infringement, and they won $700,000 from Mr. Kurtzsang at the time. At the Supreme Court, Wiley won at the lower court and at the circuit court. It's in front of the Supreme Court. The oral argument was heard in October, and we expect a decision sometime in the next month and a half as to whether Mr. Kurtzsang violated U.S. copyright law by reselling authentic textbooks that he purchased and resold out of Thailand.
So what's at stake? What does it mean from your perspective? And then I'll get some additional perspective on that from the others.
So what's at stake is whether the first sale doctrine applies for goods manufactured outside of the United States. And what that would mean is any foreign-made copyrighted goods, before they could enter the United States, would have to be subject to the copyright owner giving permission. Potentially, it may also include the possibility that even if it was the goods were resold in the United States, that the first sale doctrine could never apply since the underlying copyrighted item had never been manufactured under this title, and because of that, you would have a permanent license, the equivalent of a licensing right, to stop any downstream uses of that copyrighted good. So, for example, if you were to purchase in Japan an import CD, or not an import CD, but a Japanese CD of Elvis Presley, you couldn't resell that in the United States without the permission of the copyright owner. It also potentially includes all movies, all software, all traditional copyrighted goods, but also potentially the prior case was a case called Costco versus Omega, goods that are not traditionally copyrighted but have copyright affixed to it. Potentially they would be subject to a permanent exclusion from the first sale doctrine. What it really would mean is that if you purchase something outside of the United States, you wouldn't have the right to dispose of it in the United States.
Rather, if you purchase something outside the United States, or
if you purchased it outside of the United States or manufactured outside of the United States.
And presumably there are many goods that are purchased here but are actually manufactured outside the United States.
Correct. And then there's an open issue, and the Supreme Court may help to answer some of this, is if it was imported in, even with the importation right by the copyright owner, whether the first sale doctrine would apply in that instance also.
Mm-hmm. Keith, do you want to offer some alternative perspective on that case or additional perspective?
Yeah, so I'm with SIA, where we represent publishers, software publishers, content publishers, a little closer. And what this case means to us is it's about market segmentation. It's about the ability to treat different markets differently. It's about, you know, software companies and content companies and other copyright owners, and frankly, even beyond copyright owners, to be able to create different products for different geographical areas so they can make their works more widely available to new markets. They can make their products more affordable to markets that maybe otherwise can't afford them. They could make them more accessible, to take into account, for instance, cultural differences. They can alter their works accordingly. They can alter their works to comply with local laws like be it privacy laws, maybe it's defamation laws. You know, for instance, the same content that's distributed in some place like Saudi Arabia that might be changed so they can distribute it in Saudi Arabia, whereby here in the U.S. that work would be considerably different. It also allows, frankly, many, many benefits to consumers. This isn't just about giving publishers rights and abilities and what have you. This is about the benefits, frankly, that inure to consumers of these products, people like senior citizens and students and teachers who are able to get discounts on, I know, certainly like academic software and other products and things like that. And frankly, if this case were to go down, were to come out the wrong way, then frankly, those different models would likely disappear. What you'd see is if, for instance, academic software or let's say a book that is, a nursing textbook or something that's sold and made and sold in Thailand that's intended to be kept in Thailand and is sold at a lower price, makes its way into the United States, you'll see that book and similar books cannibalize the market here in the United States for books. And also what it might mean is that consumers will be defrauded. They may think they're getting a U.S. product. They may think they're getting the product that was intended for a U.S. audience, and frankly, they're not getting that. And so really, ultimately, like I said, this is getting back to publishers' ability to treat these different markets differently, to expand their market, and sell their products in a global environment, to sell their products globally.
So, Keith, just to follow up on that, I understand the potential
benefits of market segmentation, but what about just the practicalities of trying to enforce a rule where first sale turns on place of manufacture? I mean, does that seem like a workable principle to you?
It certainly does. I mean, that frankly, the principle's been, you know, in effect for many, many years now, and certainly, I think, you know, up to 30 years now, and we've been certainly operating, and our members have been operating under in that context. I mean, frankly, this is in terms of copyright, this is no different than any other area. I mean, we've heard the people say, well, how are we supposed to know where it's manufactured? That's no different than, frankly, the analysis of how are we supposed to know whether it's infringing or not. And yet, you know, people redistribute or sell these works all the time. That's, frankly, it's just part of the copyright law. Congress has acknowledged that, and frankly, that's just sort of one of the issues.
And Todd, back to you for a sec. So what about this market segmentation issue? I mean, isn't it a good thing that textbooks might be sold more cheaply in Thailand to be affordable to people there, and that market be separate from the market here?
Well, I guess that, I mean, under Keith's theory, there's certainly no reason to have a first sale doctrine at all for 105 years, because every argument he made about market segmentation, about providing students with lower-priced copies or senior citizens' pieces, or the ability for people to determine that they weren't reading something that wasn't intended for them, would certainly apply since 1908, because you would have wanted to stop all first sale at that point, because the original in Bob's Merrill, you would have been in a position where Macy's couldn't resell the book for below a dollar, and therefore you would have protected the bookseller at that point, copyright owner, because they may have wanted to offer a lower-priced edition for the students of the state of New York. So the arguments have been in existence for more than 105 years, and it's always the same thing. The bottom line is that when you purchase something, the alienation rights, your ability to dispose of that, should apply whether you buy it in the United States, whether you buy it in Canada, where you buy it in Thailand. And with regard to the Thai situation, why were the books being sold into the United States from Thailand? The facts of the case are pretty simple. Mr. Kurtzang was buying the books, which were nursing books, because American nursing students are trained in Thailand, and they charge a significant less amount for the same books that American nursing students charge. And then the Thai nursing students come to the United States and become nurses in the United States. So while this is really about is it's true, it's about market segmentation. And the market segmentation is that American consumers should pay more for the same goods that they could purchase overseas, and that the copyright owner can make more by segmenting markets. And it can be for textbooks, in which we hear the parade of horribles that somehow Thai students won't be educated, because it's been reimportation of textbooks have been going on way before the internet was invented. It's become easier, no question. But it's been a long stream, and you can just go back to 1908, and you can make the exact same arguments that Keith has made today that they made in that case, and you just basically say that we want a world in which everything is licensed and the copyright owner can maintain its rights for downstream limitations and manufacture wherever they wish in the world, and stop American consumers from paying the same price that they pay anywhere else.
If I could jump in, I think, you know, Todd's working under a certain premise here. He's working under the premise that, you know, the business conditions, the conditions that exist today, are going to exist tomorrow if the Supreme Court, you know, changes law or comes out in a way that favors Dr. Kurtzang here. And that, frankly, just isn't the case. I mean, if all of a sudden these works from Thailand, which are being sold less expensive or cheaper in Thailand, are able to legally come over here to the United States, well, then guess what? Those works aren't going to be sold at a lesser price in Thailand. And so because there won't be that incentive anymore, because that's ultimately going to hurt the publisher. So at the end of the day, who gets hurt here? It's the people in Thailand that would like to have these books, because all of a sudden those books are going to become more expensive. And that's not just limited to books. It's across the board. So there's a certain assumption here that's being made that the business models are going to stay the same, when frankly they just couldn't. It wouldn't make any sense.
Can I ask you a question, Keith? You
sure.
Used the example of Saudi Arabia. Do you have a single factual example of that's ever happened? That somebody purchased something in Saudi Arabia from a Saudi Arabian publisher, that was in English, let's suppose, and that it was different from what they had expected to purchase in the United States?
Okay, I swear this isn't a setup because this actually happened to me. But so in Saudi Arabia, when I was with the patent office, I went to Saudi Arabia, and I, being a baseball fan, I had this magazine. It was, and it included a big article about, I think, A League of Their Own might have been out then or something, and it had pictures in the magazine of the women baseball players in their skirts and whatever. And I was told that magazine would have been, you know, confiscated. I had to cut out all the pictures and stuff as I was on the airplane before we landed. Okay. So now, that granted, that's a different scenario. But if that publisher wanted to publish in Saudi Arabia, the way they would have been able to publish that is without the pictures, okay? And then that magazine could have ended up coming back, certainly in the United States, if in fact that were to be allowed. So, and that was a real life situation that actually did happen to me. So that's, it certainly is possible.
All right, what I think I'd like to do now that we've settled that case amicably is move on to another case. So Kurtzsang at least concerns textbooks, and books have long been subject to the first sale doctrine. But what about things like software and video games and e-books and music downloads, digital copyrighted goods? For that, I'd like to start with John, who can tell us about the case that his company is involved in, and more broadly, what his company is trying to do.
Thank you. So our case is involved in the Federal Court of New York, and last January, Capitol Records brought a copyright infringement suit against our company, which is called Redigi, Inc., and Redigi is short for Recycled Digital Media, so that'll give you an idea of where David was going with digital. And the claim basically said that for us to be able to resell lawfully downloaded digital goods. So one of the things about Redigi, and I'll just insert a little as we go, if that's all right, David. So there's.
I think it's actually probably a good idea to start with just tell people what is it that Redigi is doing, and then you can describe why you've been sued over
that. Okay, so I'll do that in context with this and tie them both together. So what Redigi does is Redigi has developed a software system, so a piece of software, that helps users identify on their computers, on their devices, which digital media they have that they lawfully obtained. So what did they pay for? So it sorts through the myriad and often the huge amounts of software that people get, whether it's, you know, file sharing song from file sharing networks or things like that, and it helps really condense it and put that into perspective with what did I lawfully obtain? And so kind of an interesting question, which is a little bit of a side note. If anybody here asks someone they know that has digital media, where did you get that from? You know, even in your music library, where did you get that from? Many people have no idea where they obtained their digital media from. It could have been from a CD a friend ripped them and gave them. It could have been something they got from a file share network or something they downloaded from iTunes. Well, Redigi clears the fog for that. So what Redigi does is it's this forensic analysis that says, this is where you got this from. And once we've found that you've lawfully acquired this, you didn't get it from a file sharing network, you didn't rip it from a CD, we have this detailed forensic analysis that says, okay, once I have this, now what can I do with it? And so what we did is, as a company, we said we want to emulate physicality. We want to try to start to give digital goods physicality. And why did we want to give digital goods physicality? We wanted to give them physicality because we know these laws exist called copyright laws, and we know that the first sale doctrine exists. So Redigi's attempt in society with what we did was to be a status quo answer, not to change the status quo, to allow the right of the consumer, the right they've always had to buy and sell goods, to be able to do the same with their digital goods. Well, Capitol Records didn't quite see it the same way, nor did they obviously like that, so they filed a complaint against us saying that with digital music from Capitol Records that we're violating their right of reproduction. That was their first claim, that we're violating their right of reproduction, because if it's digital, and if you download it digitally, the only way to transfer ownership, let's forget about first sale doctrine, although that's our panel, you have to make a reproduction. So they made the claim in the complaint that we're violating their exclusive right to reproduction. And as we move through the case and they started to realize, oops, Redigi also developed a unique way of going about the transfer of digital data, which isn't reproduction, it now became an issue of, well, if it's a digital good, should it fall under first sale? Should first sale doctrine apply? And so the Redigi response has always been, again, goods throughout time have always had the opportunity to be resold. You know, people can buy their goods, they can resell their goods. Their rights are exhausted. You know, the rights of the copyright holder are exhausted once they took that first royalty. And once that first royalty was put in their pocket, there's no further right or ongoing right to that royalty, and that's exhausted. And that's the reason for the first sale doctrine. As Todd had mentioned, Bob's Merrill and, you know, the old book issue and those types of things kind of set that standard to start. And in 1974, we all know that got more codified. But so the basis of the case then became, can this good, because it's digital, legitimately be resold under first sale doctrine? Capitol Records, in our case, went to enjoin our company. They didn't like the speed at which our company was growing, and they said, look, we need to slow them down. So they went to get an injunction, again, at the Federal Court of New York to try to prevent us from allowing our users. Redigi, again, just real quickly, is only a marketplace. We've provided the tools for users, buyers, sellers, to meet up, you know, to decide what they want to sell, and buyers decide what they want to buy and buy, and we provide help provide that marketplace. But Capital went to the Federal Court of New York and tried to get an injunction to stop us from doing business early last year. They failed in that attempt. Both companies filed for summary judgment with the Federal Court of New York. The case on summary judgment was heard around October 5th and 6th of last year as well in front of Judge Sullivan, again, Federal Court of New York. And we have yet to have a verdict in that case, David, so the verdict has not yet been reached. But both sides have provided enormous amounts of data to the court about what actually happens and how the system has proceeded. So that's a summary of the case.
And the resale company the resale market that your company is trying to promote initially is for music, is that right?
It's initially for music. But again, the premise under which we've operated is that that right should exist for any type of digital good that's, again, properly downloaded, downloaded lawfully, you know, and purchased mm-hmm. by a user, that they should yep. have the right to resell that.
Okay, so so with that principle, let me turn to Christian and again Keith and say, what about for both video games and software? What's the role of first sale and secondary markets there, and is what John talked about, trying to emulate physicality, is that even an appropriate goal?
Well, I can address the video game industry. I mean, I think if you look at where the conversation started, we're talking about a physical book, a good, right? That you know, you could run off all the pages, but to create that, only one person can have it. I mean, if Todd has it, I can look over his shoulder, right, and I can read it, but only one of us can really possess and own and get the value out of that. When we shift to what John's talking about with music files, obviously, fundamental difference is, and I think this is, you know, there's some factual issues in the case too that I don't know the particulars on about whether or not you're effectively ensuring that there's only one owner of that digital good which has been physicalized, or I'm not sure what the right word would be. So in the video game industry, you've got not much that really resembles the first case. We still have a fairly, you know, a robust segment of the market that are console games and PC games sold on CDs. And there you've got something, you know, you've got basically the beginning, the middle, and the end for some pieces of content that are packaged onto a CD and sold. And there certainly is a thriving secondary market in our industry for those hard goods. But increasingly, our industry is moving away from that model, where that model, to the extent it exists, is really a jumping-off point. And then you've got entire other models that are built upon free-to-play, freemium models, where you get the first bit of content for free or for a low entry-level price, and then sequentially, if you like what you experience, you can, you know, the hope is to continue to advance and to acquire further digital entitlements. You pay as you go for the experience you get. So. Our content publishers, by and large now, tend to have a sort of persistent, evolving relationship with their consumers centered around content that's also acquired sequentially. And in that context, the first sale doctrine, I think you can make an argument it becomes irrelevant to a certain extent. And then there's an overlay that all of these digital entitlements typically are acquired pursuant to a license. And that is, the license rights are used and apportioned in a way that, you know, I think benefits consumers equally or more so than it does publishers in terms of being able to structure the relationship in a way that works for them. And in certain closed online communities, the ability to have an in-game market that's not affected by the secondary market, I think, benefits consumers also. So I think, for video game publishers, when they look at these first sale issues, the critical issue is to be able to keep a distinction between license and ownership. That to us is really the bigger breaking point in and the ability to be able to deliver these new business models that are working, we think, for our industry and for consumers. That's really a more critical issue than trying to figure out how a digital first sale would work for something that is the digital equivalent of a book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so chime in on behalf of the software industry more as a whole. I think what Christian said is right. This is about sale versus ownership. I mean, software companies have always been digital and pretty much always been licensing their product. This isn't really sort of primary versus secondary market argument here, because if you look at a lot of software companies' licenses, a lot of them do actually allow the transfer of the software. So it allows you to transfer the software to somebody else, but it does so under certain criteria, okay? If it's academic software, for instance, it would have to be sold to a qualified educational user, a student or a teacher or something like that. And there's a lot of reasons for that, to make sure that the right person is getting the updates and the bug fixes and the online assistance and things like that, and that the person who did sell or transfer the software no longer has retained a copy. So, but that's controlled in specified in the license agreement itself. I'm not saying all license agreements provide for that, but quite a few do. So the idea here is not to shut down any type of secondary market, but rather, frankly, to control it and to make sure that the primary and secondary markets work efficiently and effectively, not only for the publishers, but for the users of the software as well.
So let me get John and Todd in on that then. So digital goods are often sold via licenses now rather than outright sale. And they've suggested that may be good in some ways for consumers, may empower some new business models, and may allow some control of the secondary markets in ways that may be beneficial. What's your response to that?
So it's really it's a fundamental question as we go forward as to whether we want an ownership world or a licensing world. And certainly there's no question that there's not a publisher out there that would not like to control both the primary market and the secondary market. And because that means all the rents will go to them. That makes perfect sense. And that makes absolutely perfect sense. But that has been an historic fact basically since the 1500s that any publisher of any good would like to control the secondary market also, on behalf of itself and on behalf of, and I don't necessarily agree with this, on behalf of the user. Because the user in the Redigi case can certainly say, why should I only use your official secondary market to sell a good that I purchased that was called a sale, that wasn't described as a rent, that wasn't described as a license, unless, how many of us, as Keith said, as we reviewed our software licenses, because nobody reviews a software license except for us at the panel. But that's the point, which is what are the expectations of consumers and what are the ways in which they can make the best decisions for what they do with the goods and services they purchase, and whether the rights and the secondary rights go to be ultimately always controlled by the publisher, because there's no end, right? Because under the magic term license, that means that they can control it forever, or whether it's something in which we've said that so long as they use and dispose, and if they can build the system that allows it for the publisher to control the secondary right, there's nothing that stops that publisher or for any other third party from also ensuring that the good was disposed of in the same manner on the first purchaser and then transferred to the second purchaser. This is really a question about who wants the rents. It's not a question about whether or not you can protect the user.
John, if you'd like to get in, I'll let you.
No, I completely agree with what Todd said, obviously. I mean, but I think it even goes deeper than that. When you look at the people that are affected ultimately by where that decision goes, and it was nice to hear the software industry guys saying, look, they're all for a secondary market, and, you know, they write licenses to allow it, you know, in this command and control type of mentality, which is awesome. We're going to look forward to that. But it's also interesting to look beyond that, and when we look into the record industry, for example, and I'm not sure if there are many people here or any people from the record industry, but you know, there's been this ongoing argument and controversy of when an artist, and you know, I came from this panel earlier today about music, and you know, there's all this talk about making sure the artists get paid, and it's really interesting when you look at music, and you know, was it downloaded as a license or was it downloaded as a sale, and when you start to wrap yourself into the detail of that, you find, on one hand, the labels in the majority of cases are paying the artist as if it were a sale. Why? We all know that. What's driving this? It's about money. They're paying the artist at a sale rate rather than, and I know there's an artist right here because this young lady from Sweden spoke up at that meeting. But the labels pay the artist as if it were a license, or if it were a sale, because they can pay less. Then on the other hand, they want to say, okay, well, now to everybody else out there, this is a license. And why do I want to treat it as a license to you? Because I don't want to have this secondary market out there. So there's, on one hand, I want it this way. On the other hand, I want it this way. Now, if some of the holders of these copyrights were to say, okay, this is always a license, and you know, you artists out there that I'm paying this nominal percentage, so I actually pay you 50% of the revenue generated because it really indeed is a license, not a sale, then we'd start to see things change and how that perception is, but that's not what's happening. So I think, you know, this issue is a deep and big issue, and Todd's said it very correctly about, you know, the words and how they're used and what people will do with those if we're not, as consumers, careful, and business people careful about how those are perceived, because they'll end up just like the artist who's at both ends where they're not getting what they maybe rightfully deserve under one case or the other.
Christian?
Yeah, I think it's important to separate two different scenarios. I mean, I think in the Redigi scenario, you're without, you know, taking a position on the specific case, you're talking about you know, looking for purchases of goods that happen because they happen to be in digital form that requires a reproduction, you know, an exercise of one of the exclusive copyrights in order to make a sale, a second sale. You know, you've got a legal issue there under copyright because of the nature of the medium in which the content is delivered. And there may be an antecedent question there, or the bigger policy question of whether the fact that the piece of media involved in that case, or any specific piece of media, should be treated as a policy matter the same as a hard good, because the bargain, the consumer-publisher bargain, is the same. I think from the video game industry perspective, we're looking much more commonly at a different sort of situation where the bargain and the relative benefits of the bargain are very different, where you're purchasing something, you're purchasing content or sequential content that you continue to download over time as part of a package that also includes a lot of services wrapped around it. And most of that content may never reside on your hard drive. It may, or 80 to 90% of it may reside in cloud servers that the publishers are paying the carrying cost for and the operation cost for. So you've got a situation there where what you are acquiring is defined at the outset, and it's priced in. The fact that you may be acquiring the ability to access your last stopping point in a game across six different platforms through one single sign-in, and you've paid accordingly for the price to be able to do that. You're not actually acquiring anything that you can turn and sell to someone else. So for us, the license ownership distinction works very well to create to have license rights recognized creates a lot of flexibility to strike bargains that I do think it's not merely lip service; it is actually beneficial to consumers as well as content creators.
Go ahead, John. Make a brief comment on that. And Redigi is absolutely all for licenses as well, as I'm sure most people are. But what we're for is that freedom of knowledge and information be put to the consumer so that they absolutely understand what they're getting when they get it and that they know what to do with it once they have it. And if a consumer decides, look, rental or license or something that's very obvious to me is the way I want to go versus ownership, great. I mean, there's enough people out there that will want different models. And I think what needs to happen is people need to understand what they're actually getting and what the ramification of that decision is when they push a button, not read a 53-page agreement and expect people to understand what that means. But when they actually do it, they understand what they are getting, very clear and simple. And there's room for both. There's room for many models. We're not saying there should be one.
And let me, if I could jump in to ask both John and Todd sort of a question, is how do you do that then, right? I mean, the software, as I mentioned before, the software industry has been, you know, it's always been digital. It's pretty much always been, you know, licensing model, okay? And, yes, people don't go through 53-page license agreements necessarily, but you know, it's been this way, at least in the software industry, forever. So you talk about consumer expectations and things. How do you educate consumers, especially with things moving so quickly? Now, we see in the software industry is changing dramatically, as well as many other copyright industries and industries as a whole, where the software industry is moving to the cloud. It's becoming more like a service. And how, you know, you talk about consumer expectations, but in sort of with technology moving so quickly, how do you do that? How do you do that in a way with and it's not just a one size fits all. It's not just okay, all software companies are going to do it this way. I mean, maybe that's what consumers would like. We have to change the antitrust laws to be able to do that. But that's a difficult. And the software industry, I know at least you know our members are trying to do what they can to do that, to make sure consumers absolutely know what they're getting.
Okay. I think it's a good question, and I think, you know, not to keep harping on music, but I definitely have an affinity for music and a lot of things associated with it. But, you know, one of the things the music industry has done is they've created a model that's called the streaming model. And so, for example, with their streaming model, we talked earlier today about Spotify and, you know, the selection where people can spend $10 a month or whatever fee service they happen to have. And for their $10 a month, they're renting the ability to be able to listen to this music. And it's pretty clear that that's what they're getting on Spotify. So if someone wants to rent music for 3 years and spend $360 to rent, and they just say, I don't really want to do this anymore, and they stop, they actually have nothing left at the end of it. So they're sitting there and they go, okay, now I spent my $360. I don't have anything of tangible value, which I think actually the industry should really want. The industry should really want music and other things to have tangible value, not this intangible stuff that people feel is okay to file share. But that's another subject. But so after streaming 3 years, they have this thing that has no tangible value. And they decide, okay, now what am I going to do? I'm going to start a new playlist or library. I start from ground zero. That's fine. They understand it. If they come to Redigi, and I'll put a pitch in, not that I'm supposed to be doing that, but if they come to Redigi and they spend that same $360, they're going to have, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 700-plus songs, let's say, that are going to be on their library. And at the end of that 3 years, they might not want those songs anymore. They have the right to resell those, and they probably have $360 worth of value in that. So they understand that when they come to us. They understand when they go to Spotify, they have nothing. And I think that's a very important distinction and key in whatever type of communications happen with the consumers, that they clearly understand what their ownership is or is not.
And I see it in the iPad experience, right? We all understand that we're going to pay $2.99 to rent the film and watch it for 24 hours over a 30-day period, and that's it. Once the 24-hour period starts, and we'll pay $2.99 standard definition and $3.99 high definition. But then I'm told also that I can buy it for $14.99, but I'm limited to the 5 computers. I can't transfer it to... It's not descendable. I can't transfer it to anybody else. But yet, I was told I could buy it, and technically, I bought the license, and it was a limited time license or a limited use license. And so the consumer confusion is pretty high. But we kind of go back to the StubHub model, which is that where is there greater long-term value for everybody? Is it a world in which you want all of the secondary market controlled by the publisher? And let me tell you, I can assure you, in the tickets world, which is probably the first true digital good that we're all pretty much using. There's no question that the Ticketmasters of the world and their clients would like to make sure that the only place you can buy a secondary market ticket is from themselves. And that certainly would eliminate every problem of the parade of horribles that gets described in the world of, if we don't control it, bad things will happen. For example, counterfeits and a whole bunch of other things. But yet, we know from consumers' experience that open markets provide far more value for not just the secondary purchaser, not just the first purchaser and the first seller, but also for the underlying markets. That economically, open, broad, secondary markets help publishers more than the control. But yet, because of the structure of the market and the desire to maximize 100% the profits, there's not a publisher that wants to allow for a secondary market.
See, but that's, I mean, I explained earlier that there are software companies, like I said, they're not getting paid extra money to allow the transfer. They're allowing the transfer from the person who originally licensed the software to transfer to another person, and they're not asking for any additional rents or anything like that. You also mentioned the fact that, you know, publishers are trying to control all the secondary market, and we're talking about the first sale doctrine here, right? And so the first sale doctrine is this exception in the copyright law, but there are other provisions in the copyright law. And you look at Costco versus Omega, for instance. In that case, the court basically split 4-4, so the Ninth Circuit opinion controls, and Omega prevailed in that case on the first sale question, but they didn't prevail entirely. It went back to the district court where they held against Omega on copyright misuse. There are other provisions in the copyright law that would apply. You've got things like the suitcase exception in 602. You've got fair use exception, certainly, which I think would also apply in the Costco versus Omega case. You've got doctrines of implied license. There's a whole bunch of different exceptions either in the copyright law itself or imposed by the courts over time that could certainly apply. And also, I should mention the fact that we're talking about secondary markets. We're talking about products that are made, at least under the Kurtzing analogies, products that are made and sold outside the United States. What about products that are made in the United States? You still have the secondary market potentially for those items.
Right. So in the real world, Keith, Rosetta Stone. I pay $400 for my Rosetta Stone Italian, and automatically I learn it overnight. And then I decide, you know what, overnight I don't want to learn Italian because it doesn't, just by placing it into my computer, I don't learn Italian. And so I choose to resell that good, right? And what am I told? What's the Rosetta Stone license?
I have to admit Rosetta Stone's not a member, so I'm not familiar with their license, so I'll have to plead ignorance on that particular.
They prohibit the resale of any one of their products.
Okay, that happens to be, like I said, one software company. Like I said, I didn't say the universe of software companies do that. It sounds like you would like the universe of software companies to allow the transfer, and then we're getting into sort of antitrust issues potentially.
Well, no, I think we're going into what Christian said, which is, what is the reproduction right meant to do? The reproduction right, as it's described and as it's been interpreted by the court, is that any reproduction is prohibited. But the underlying principle was really about distributing additional copies to other people. That's what the reproduction right was meant to prohibit, so that you couldn't make multiple copies of the same good and either distribute it, and the distribution right takes advantage of that also. But also, it was not about reproducing for the sake of reproducing, so that you could transfer the same good or the same underlying good.
So Christian's waiting to get in. Just before he does that, let me ask one final question after he makes a comment, then I'd like to try to get some questions from the audience. My final question for really everyone on the panel will be, since we're here under the auspices of the Congressional Internet Caucus, what, if anything, should Congress be considering doing in this area, and are there outcomes of the two cases that we've described that depending how those cases come out, you think Congress might need to act? But first, Christian.
I think I can tie my response to that question, my comment, because my response to your question is nothing. No, I don't think we need new legislation in this area. And I just want to address Todd's comment that, in using the StubHub analogy, that in all places and all times, it's good for the publishers. And if you follow that line, you'll never really examine what's up for the consumers. As someone who both is an avid participant in the secondary market for tickets and purchased my great seats to the horrifying last game of the Washington Nationals season on StubHub.
Oh my God.
They did not offer refunds, no matter how harrowing the experience was. and as someone who also enjoys playing, multiplayer online games, I can tell you that it isn't a one-size-fits-all experience, because in the online multiplayer game market, there are both types of games, like World of Warcraft by Blizzard, that are meant to be closed in-game economies where the publisher goes to painstaking lengths to make sure that the assets and the ability to acquire and exchange those assets in the game is supposed to work in a balanced economy. So if you pay your $15 a month and you spend for the amount of time investment, money investment you make in the game, you're able to have a good experience. And the vast majority of players loathe the unauthorized secondary market that's built up around that game, where you can basically pay to get ahead in the game because it upsets the experience for others. There are other types of online game experiences where everyone goes in eyes wide open into a different experience. And the publisher may control the secondary market there, but it operates in the same way that the independent secondary market operates on eBay. And there may be a supplemental market on eBay that doesn't upset that in-game economy, because everybody knows that you're allowed to use real money to buy and sell and get your way ahead. And everybody goes in and agrees this is the way we're going to play and we're all going to have the experience. So while I certainly agree that it's a fair statement to say most publishers would also always like to control both primary and secondary markets because it behooves their bottom line interest, I think it's important to note that it isn't that crystal clear in all instances, and we see it play out in the video game industry in particular.
So to this question of, are there things Congress should either be doing now or things it should be looking out for in these upcoming cases to possibly require action? Keith, any?
Yeah, I think, frankly, that's just going to take some time to figure that out, because we'll have to see what the Supreme Court says. I mean, what they have till the end of June, I believe, and so we'll find out what that decision says. There's three possibilities, presumably. One is obviously agreeing with Kurtzing. The other is to, agree with the publishers that, what's made in Thailand and sold in Thailand stays in Thailand. And then there's a potentially middle ground, which is the government's, the government's decision, I believe, also the Ninth Circuit says, which is if it's made and sold in Thailand, yes, it stays in Thailand. But if it's made and then shipped to the U.S. under the authority of the copyright owner, then, the first sale defense would apply, which is sort of a compromise position. If they're somehow able to find language to hang their hat on with that, then, frankly, maybe neither side, is sort of happy. I mean, maybe both sides or all the sides are happy with the that sort of middle ground. But like I said, it just remains to be seen where the court comes out here.
Todd?
Well, we think it's a pretty fundamental principle that Congress would have never intended that copyrighted goods manufactured outside of the United States would receive more protection and have no first sale doctrine than copyrighted goods manufactured in the United States. So we're fairly clear and would advocate pretty strongly that the moment, if the Supreme Court rules in either of the two negative scenarios from our view, that manufacturing should not matter as to where the copyright, for copyright purposes, for the first sale doctrine should apply. Once you've sold something, your rights are exhausted no matter where it is manufactured in the world.
John?
Again, I would probably echo those sentiments and just add to it that, just because something hasn't been specified in the first sale doctrine, i.e., location of manufacture, or i.e., it's a digital good versus a physical good, doesn't mean they're absent from the protection of the law. And I think that if Congress did want to get involved or did want to act, would be only to expand the understanding that those things are not excluded just because they weren't conceived at the point in time they were
considered. Okay. We're short on time, but let's try a couple questions if we can from the audience. Emery. There's a microphone there, so I think it probably works best
if
you speak into that.
That's a question. You have to stand.
So I have a purely technological question for you, John, which is how does your technology ensure that the first person actually stops owning a copy?
Okay, that's an excellent question, and I'm going to help put it in perspective before I answer it. So,
it does it
in a very, very good way. But the perspective is this: the perspective is, before you came in here, you walked outside and you sold a CD to someone down. Someone sold you a CD, or you purchased one from them downstairs. And when they sold that CD to you during that transaction, you have no knowledge as to whether or not they actually ripped it to their iTunes folder. It's now on their phone, their iPad, you know, several different devices, maybe five, maybe more. You know, it depends not only on the user agreement, but just on people's practices. So when that sale transaction happened, the law of today, what we're in today, allowed that transaction to happen lawfully under first sale doctrine. And it didn't require you or the person you did that transaction with to go back and make sure that everything you might have ever made of that CD has been removed. Now, you're supposed to lawfully you're violating copyright if you didn't, but there's no enforcement structure for that. But the reason I like your question is because what Redigi has done is we've actually built a higher level of copyright protection than ever has existed by now looking at how do we define a lawfully obtained digital good. Once we have defined that item, our system basically acts like antivirus software. So the technology we're asking about, Redigi is like this big antivirus software. It's probably the most easy way for people to understand it. And what it does is whenever you connect or sync a device to it, unlike when you did that with your CD, we say, hey, guess what? We found another copy of it. Because we put a kernel in there just like antivirus, that whenever we see it pop up again, whether it's in a cloud, on a device, wherever it happens to be, we say, hey, you have a copy here that you don't have the legal right to anymore. So what Redigi does, being a marketplace, we're not the police, but what we do is we help you maintain compliance to copyright law. You were asking about our technology. Our technology helps keep you out of jail.
And so Redigi looks at the user's hard drive, or where does it look to see if that?
Wherever it happens to look, wherever you connect with, we look at. So, you know, wherever you want to put it, wherever you want to let us look at it, we do. So right now, if you download it to, say, a desktop, we have a desktop application, we have a mobile application, but it will look at that, and then anything you connect to from that we'll look at, and we'll help the user maintain compliance to copyright law because it's their obligation to be compliant. And their obligation when they sold the CD was to go back and delete all those copies from the iTunes library, which I guarantee you they probably never did, but under Redigi they are having to do it because if they don't do it, there's a ramification. So there's actually a high level of copyright protection.
But
please, go ahead.
The burden is still on me to police myself. You're
but
just
it always
cutting me out of the fridge.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Other questions? Yeah.
So this question is for Todd. Both of your examples that you gave as far as the Rosetta Stone and buying a movie or renting a movie from iTunes, it seems to me that the problem you're identifying is that consumers don't know what they're getting. So assuming that we can solve that problem, right, by clearly delineating what that is, would that solve the issue for you, or do you think that producers should have an obligation to give a purchase option?
Yeah, no, I don't think that would solve the situation. It wouldn't solve it in Bob's Merrill, the original first sale case, where the book was stamped saying this book may not be resold for less than $1. So they were clearly on notice. The consumer knew that they couldn't, quote, resell it. But the restraint on alienation was what was the more important principle. Just because somebody knows that they can't allegedly do something doesn't mean that you should prohibit them from engaging in an activity that benefits society much broader, which is resales. So no, I don't think that would solve the problem at all.
Any other questions? Quiet room. All right. Well, we're a little past 3:00, so let's thank our panel.
Thank you very much.